This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. It's still years away from completion, but the US 70 bypass in Havelock should make your trip to the beach faster. A public meeting was held Monday night at the Havelock Tourist and Events Center, where residents were able to ask questions and share their concerns with North Carolina Department of Transportation officials. This week, I spoke with DOT Eastern Region Project Development Section Head Robert Hansen and Project Engineer Brian Yamamoto about how the bypass could affect residents, how they use comments from the public, and the plan moving forward.
The first scoping documents for this were in the early 90s, so it's been underway for quite a while.
How many different alternatives is North Carolina Department of Transportation considering for this Havelock bypass?
The alternatives have gone through sort of a screening process. There's quite a range of alternatives in the early scoping of the project. And since that time, we were down to alternate 3 as the one selected alternative.
And could you tell us about this preferred alternative?
Brian, you might be better to describe the location and everything.
Yeah. The alternative is roughly 10.5 miles long, end to end. It's kind of strange. US 70 is signed east-west, but it sort of takes a north-south turn there in Havelock to where the roadway is running almost north and south there. So directionally, this thing is actually going to the west of Havelock, and it's going into a portion of the Croatan Forest on new location. On the north end, it's departing just a little bit south of Carolina Pines. And I think that the closest good landmark for you, it's tying in just south of McOtter Boulevard.
Now, there was a public meeting held on Monday. Can you tell me how many people attended that?
I would estimate in the range of 150.
What was the response like? And did you get a lot of feedback?
We got a lot of feedback. To be honest, we had a lot of questions about impacts to personal property. However, the striking thing, normally at those things, you will have at least a segment of people that don't like the project at all. And I think in general, I was not hearing much negative about the project itself. It seems like the public at large is tired of the traffic problems there in Havelock, and they're ready to see this come.
If I can only add to that, I did hear there was some frustration from some of the property owners about how long this process has taken. So we certainly heard that loud and clear. Some of the members of the public out there just wanted us to get this project wrapped up.
How many homes and businesses would be impacted by this bypass?
Right. We're estimating at 18 total.
That includes the businesses and one nonprofit as well. So there's only one business and one nonprofit, but 16 residences.
How are you going to assist those residents with either relocation or reimbursement for using their property?
There'll be a process for an appraiser to work with those property owners, review the project plans with them, showing how much property would be involved that DOT would need to acquire for this bypass. We would try to make sure we understand their interest in the property and what value they have in it from their perspective. DOT would develop an offer for those properties. If a home actually has to be relocated, if the house is actually in the path of the bypass, there are also relocation assistance services that are offered to assist those property owners in finding a new place to live.
Is there a better route that would have less of an impact on residents?
Of the 3 that we narrowed it down to, there was one alternate that had 2 less residential relocations. However, that one went a bit further into the Croatan National Forest, and there were concerns about how much of the wildlife habitat was being fragmented since that stretched so far into the Croatan National Forest. The alternate 3 that we did select does have 2 additional relocations, but balancing the impacts to the human environment and then balancing that versus the impacts to the natural environment. We had one more that was under study that was closer into town, so would have reduced the habitat impacts. But relocating of residences on that one was more than 100 relocations, so I believe 133 homes would have to be relocated with that one.
And if people missed the meeting on Monday night, can they still get their comments in?
The comment period will be open the remainder of September. We've got a 30-day comment period for that, so we're certainly welcoming any any feedback from the public on the project, and specifically looking for any tweaks to the design that they would have seen Monday night.
If you already have a preferred alternative, are comments from residents really going to be taken into consideration as you move forward with development?
That's a good question. We've got a what we call a preliminary design right now. We have selected the corridor of those three large concept corridors. So now it's a question of trying to get that one design down to where it works best for everybody before we start that right-of-way purchase process. You know, once we get to the part of actually buying land for the project, that's going to be some very detailed plans. So this is sort of the opportunity for the public to get their comments in before those final plans are developed.
We're speaking with Eastern Region Project Development Section Head Robert Hansen and Project Engineer Brian Yamamoto. Thank you.
Hey, welcome. Thank you, Jared.
Salisbury, North Carolina, population just shy of 34,000, can now lay claim to the title of city with the fastest internet in the U.S. It's not operated by Google, Verizon, or Time Warner Cable. Instead, it's a homegrown fiber optic network. WFAE's Ben Bradford says when city officials launched it, the only title they were seeking was employed.
Salisbury is one of those classic American towns with a prototypical Main Street. Old buildings, mom-and-pop shops, storefront windows, a church bell gongs out the time. But at the very end of the historic section, there's a larger office building with Integro Technologies inside.
So we build final inspection systems, cosmetic inspection systems, packaging systems, robotic cells.
Company IT head Pat LeFerrier says it requires fast internet. Integro buys from the city of Salisbury, which started its own provider a few years ago. LeFerrier says it's fast.
We've got people that download hundreds of gigabytes a day, and without that speed, it would drive everybody nuts.
Fibrant, as it's called, offers download speeds of 1 gigabit per second. That's about 20 times faster than Time Warner Cable's fastest offering in Charlotte, and the same speed as Google's much-ballyhooed fiber optic network operating in Kansas City and under construction in Charlotte and Raleigh. But as of yesterday, Salisbury now offers an even faster speed, 10 gigabits, the fastest internet, the city claims, available to all residents in any city. That wasn't the original plan, says Mayor Paul Woodson. He says 10 years ago, the city council looked to attract companies like Integro, not break any records.
All we're trying to do is differentiate ourselves from other cities. We lost our mills. We lost our furniture factories. We decided we needed to do something to replace the manufacturing that was, the whole country was losing, not just Salisbury, the whole country. So that's how we got started.
The council began to explore the idea of a faster fiber optic data network to lure new technology jobs. Assistant City Manager John Softley says the city first approached the cable companies that already offered internet.
None of them were interested in doing anything beyond what they were doing.
Cable traditionally uses copper wire to send electrical signals. Fiber optics embed the data in light, which can be much faster, but requires a major overhaul, says Christopher Mitchell, who tracks community-owned broadband.
The main thing is that the existing cable and telephone companies really don't want to invest in the fiber network. Fundamentally, you have to take these fiber optic cables and connect everyone's house with them.
So Salisbury became one of the few U.S. cities to commission its own, using $33 million in bonds. Fibrant began operating in 2010, first at lower speeds, and then offering 1 gigabit last year for about $100 a month to interested residents. So far, only a handful. As city officials tell it, they weren't looking to go faster. But then in December, the city hired Kent Windrick. He'd been working on fiber networks that stretched across Europe. Windrick thought Fibrant could go much faster than 1 gigabit, or technically even 10.
Actually, the fiber, I believe, is capable of well over 100 gigs.
The problem is getting the hardware on each end of the cable to match those speeds. The city was already going to replace some routers. He saw an opportunity to upgrade.
We changed out our router, and we realized that we could actually bump this up and be the first city in the world to do it. So, and we were just scratching our heads going, really? We're going to be the first ones? And we kept checking with everybody that we knew, and they said, well, we don't know of anybody. So we just kind of jumped all over it, and it was really very easy to do, surprisingly easy to do.
The cost will vary for businesses, but in the range of $400 per month, Windrick says. Catawba College is the first user, with one connection and more planned. Governor Pat McCrory returned to his alma mater to announce the network. He said when he started on campus, his parents gave him an electric typewriter.
I thought at that point in time, technology couldn't get any better.
And he touted Fibrant's economic potential.
It will help us in recruiting new jobs for North Carolina, for this entire region.
Possibly. But Mayor Woodson admits the FAST network has been slow to attract customers. He says it has about 3,300 businesses and residents right now, short of the goal of 4,500.
Right now we've got some small companies coming in, some engineering skill companies. They're bringing in 15 or 20, 25 high-paid people. But we still need the bigger jobs. We still need to pull people in where the big plants are coming in.
Now that it has arguably the fastest network in the country, the question is if Fibrant can achieve its original goal. For WFAE News, I'm Ben Bradford in Salisbury.
You may have seen the article in Jacksonville Daily News about a recent close encounter with a manatee in eastern North Carolina. It may be a stretch for manatees to venture this far north, but for Carteret County resident Ken Banks, seeing is believing.
That's the first one I've ever seen. It's a sight to behold, I will say that.
Early Sunday morning, Banks received a call from his neighbor who was on a boat in a marina west of Cape Carteret.
The manatee came up beside his boat, and of course he called a couple that live around the marina, and we walked down to the docks and the manatee was actually swimming along under the floats on the dock.
Banks and several others gathered at the dock to marvel at the manatee for about an hour. He says it would go beneath the water for 15 minutes and then resurface.
I could have reached down and touched him. He was a big one, probably 10, 11 feet, lots of barnacles. So I guess they move so slow barnacles can attach.
Surprisingly, manatee sightings in coastal North Carolina are not terribly rare. In 2009, there were 6 sightings. That number doubled in 2010 and increased to 17 sightings in 2011. The upward trend hasn't stopped. Research technician with UNCW's Marine Mammal Program, Aaron Cummings, says there was a total of 30 manatee sightings in 2012.
They're reported to venture up this way during the summer season, all the way dating back to the 1930s. There's more and more people. We get more and more sighting reports. So we think that there may be an increase in the number of manatees that are venturing up this way during the summer.
Manatees grow up to 13 feet long and weigh more than 1,800 pounds. An endangered species, they're usually found in the warm waters of coastal Florida. But during the summer, manatees have been spotted as far north as Connecticut. Scientists don't know exactly what causes them to migrate so far from their native waters. Cummings says it may have something to do with competition for food sources.
North Carolina has a lot of waterways and a lot of seagrasses. There definitely are resources here for them.
According to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, manatees may spend about 5 hours a day feeding and may consume 4 to 9% of their body weight a day. It makes sense that they would migrate to areas like the North Carolina coast where food sources are abundant. Cummings says there have been 13 sightings so far this year, coming from marinas, rivers, and the intercoastal waterway. Although manatees prefer fresh water, some have been actually spotted swimming around piers at the Outer Banks this summer.
A lot of sightings that we have go unreported, so we have to rely on people to know which number to call and to actually report the sightings.
June to October is the best chance to see a manatee in eastern North Carolina. That makes sense, since the most recent sighting happened less than a week ago.
I have not seen him since, and I don't know that anybody else has.
Banks, who saw the adult manatee off Bogue Sound on Sunday, says he didn't report the encounter, hoping to keep onlookers at bay.
It's a private community. I was a little fearful that we might have, you know, a lot of boats coming in and actually endangering it, you know, maybe hitting it.
Collisions with watercraft happen all too frequently. According to Defenders of Wildlife, more than 80 manatees are struck and killed from watercraft-related incidents each year. Cummings urges boaters to exercise caution when you know a manatee is in the area.
Stay at a safe distance. Don't swim with it. Don't pet it. Don't feed it. We want it to do its usual thing and move around and return back to Florida. So admire it, take pictures of it, but just leave it be.
In a month or two, most manatees will head south to warmer waters. Until then, Cummings is encouraging people to report their sightings. Scientists depend on the information to monitor manatee migration habits. Information on location, number of manatees spotted, and a description of the animal is helpful for documentation. If you happen on a manatee in Brunswick, New Hanover, Pender, or Onslow counties, Contact any coastal North Carolina agency, and they report it to the Marine Mammal Program at UNCW, where Cummings will add it to the manatee spotting database. You can also contact the program directly. There's a phone number to report manatee sightings posted on our website, publicradioeast.org. We've also posted a video of Ken Banks' manatee encounter. That's at publicradioeast.org. The New Bern Historical Society is presenting the first in a series of lunch and learn events next Wednesday. The topic is Women on the Home Front During the Civil War. Tryon Palace Assistant Director Lorraine Umfleet will be giving the presentation, and this week Mac McKee spoke with her about the role women in eastern North Carolina played in the war between the states.
The Civil War lasted from 1861 to 1865. Lorraine, when was New Bern occupied by Union troops during that period? How did the occupation galvanize women to help out on the home front?
New Bern fell to Union occupation in March of 1862. And at that time, the women of New Bern, those who could, fled. Those who couldn't, stayed. And they had varying degrees of experiences under Union occupation. Some challenged it. Some stayed hidden in their homes.
In your presentation, you cover a variety of topics. You say that women, and I'll use this word in quotes, rioted over the lack of flour in Salisbury. Now, we know in the 19th century that term probably, riot and women, probably didn't go together. But what actually happened in that incident?
Well, in Salisbury, the city was predominantly managed by the military for the use of the prison. The Confederate government had a prisoner of war camp in Salisbury, and all available supplies went to the prison. And the women of the area needed flour just to be able to feed their families, and they were willing to pay fair market value for that flour, but the speculators were charging much more than fair market for the flour for outside of the military needs. And the ladies of Salisbury said that they weren't going to do that anymore and that they just wanted to pay fair market value. And so women stepping outside of their traditional roles and pushing back against military authority was considered a riot in Salisbury.
Now, how long did this situation last before it was settled?
Not very long at all. It was just one afternoon of activity with the ladies, quote unquote, breaking into the storehouses and acquiring the flour that they wanted. And then the military authorities pushed back, and then the politicians got involved, and the state of North Carolina realized that it needed to do a better job of caring for the widows and indigent population in the state, particularly for people whose soldiers were away, and it did change policy in the big picture.
The romantic side of history, especially when it comes to TV and movies, likes to portray Southern women as spies or maybe double agents. Now, according to your presentation, this romantic stereotype seems to be more true than fiction. Were there any prominent New Bern or Eastern North Carolina women who spied for the Confederacy?
It wasn't all that romantic. We tend to look back on history and have rose-colored glasses, but there were women who were willing to put themselves at risk to serve the greater good for what they conceived of as the Confederacy. One of these girls was Emmeline Pigott. She was living in New Bern and collected information about Union troop movements in and around the town and would send that information out to the Confederate troops on the perimeter of New Bern. And she was captured for spying, and she was to be searched. She managed to do away with the incriminating evidence before her search happened while she was imprisoned at the Jones House, which is on Tryon Palace property today.
In South Carolina, a lot of people have heard of Mary Chestnut's diary, chronicling everyday life at home away from the battlefield. Does New Bern or North Carolina in general have a woman that fulfilled that same role?
North Carolina women wrote a lot during the Civil War about their experiences. One large diary that rivals Mary Chestnut's is Catherine Devereaux Edmonston, and she was from the Halifax area, and her diary is for the whole war and very detailed. It gives you a great amount of information. She also, if she had been a blogger today, she would have had a daily blog. Other women from North Carolina were people such as Mary Norcott Bryan. She was a North Carolinian. She was from New Bern, and she wrote her reminiscences after the Civil War. She refugeed out of the city before the occupation.
With soldiers returning from war, how important were Southern women's contributions to the rebuilding of society?
When the men came back after April 1865 and the surrender, it was their responsibility to return home to home, whatever home was or wherever home was. And many times these soldiers had physical and not so physical injuries that had to be dealt with. Some had battlefield wounds, some had amputations, and others had what we now call PTSD, but they didn't have a label or an understanding of what that was. And it was the duty of the women to create a new home in a new time after such a horrible war. And many found outlets in what became known as the United Daughters of the Confederacy. And those ladies in Fayetteville erected the first monument in the state to the Confederate dead there at the cemetery in Fayetteville.
Lorraine, where and when is your presentation taking place?
It's on Wednesday, September 9th at 11:30 at the Chelsea.
And remember, if you need more information, you can check out our website at publicradioeast.org. Lorraine, thank you for being our guest today.
Thank you so much.
This is Lisa Rayburn, horticulture agent with Onslow County Cooperative Extension, here with this week's edition of The Garden Journal. So summer's coming to a close, and fall is just around the corner. And when you walk in the garden center, winterizing fertilizers seem to be front and center in the aisles. It's almost like the Christmas decorations of the lawn and garden center. These fertilizers may give you the idea that a winterizing feeding is a desirable practice for your lawn. But that's not necessarily true in our area. Both warm and cool season grasses grow in North Carolina, and most winterizing fertilizers don't differentiate between the two. Cool season grasses like fescue grow during the cool temperatures of spring and fall, so they benefit from fall fertilization. On the other hand, warm season grasses like centipede, St. Augustine, Bermuda grass, and zoysia are entering dormancy during the fall. These warm season grasses can be injured by fertilizers containing nitrogen if they're applied too late in the season. Nitrogen is the first number on a bag of fertilizer. Most lawns in coastal North Carolina are warm season lawns, and they can be damaged when nitrogen is applied too late or too heavily. Nitrogen fertilizers actually promote shoot growth at the same time that the plant's metabolism is slowing as the plant starts to enter dormancy. This results in the plant not being able to store carbohydrates and can add stress to the plant. The new tender shoots that are put out are also less tolerant of cold temperatures and are more susceptible to fungal diseases like large patch. The additional nitrogen will, however, be available to cool season weeds, and that's the last thing you need. So late season fertilization with nitrogen is not desirable in warm season turfs. However, potassium may be a beneficial nutrient for your lawn. Potassium is the third number on a bag of fertilizer. Potassium plays a key role in winterizing because it's been shown to enhance cold tolerance in grasses and other plants. If a soil test indicates that your soil is low in potassium, it can be applied at a rate of 1 pound of potassium per 1,000 square feet of lawn. Materials available include muriate of potash, which is 0060 on the label, or potassium sulfate, which is 0050 on the label. You'll notice that neither of those fertilizers has any nitrogen or the first number on the label. Just remember that if you've been fertilizing throughout the summer with fertilizers that contain potassium, and many of our turf fertilizers do, it's unlikely that you need potassium in the fall because it should already be out there. Other than working out the fertilizer, there are several other steps you can take to encourage a healthy lawn going into winter. First, you can encourage your lawn to store energy by raising the height of your lawnmower by half an inch in mid-September. The correct height to mow your grass to depends on the type of turf that you have. It varies from 1 inch for centipede in Bermuda to up to 3 inches for St. Augustine. If you have an irrigation system, be sure to cut back on the amount of water being applied to the lawn. As temperatures start to cool in the fall and the days shorten, your grass does not require as much water. Cut back to no more than half an inch per week by mid-September. Make sure you keep the leaves off of your turf as they fall. Leaves prevent the turf from photosynthesizing and storing carbohydrates as it goes into dormancy. If you've had problems in the past with winter annual weeds, like annual bluegrass, you can minimize the issue by applying pre-emergent herbicides in September before weeds start coming up. Which herbicide to use depends on the type of grass you have and which weeds have been an issue. Long-term weed management relies on promoting a thick, healthy growth by following correct practices in your turf. So maintain your turf now going into winter to help promote a nice green lawn next summer.
Thanks for listening to the Down East Journal. Have a great Labor Day weekend.